Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Again, William Nacy for the appellant this morning. Your Honor, this case boils down to, really, in my opinion, one issue. Did Mr. Cannon have any rights to unsupervised visitation or custody prior to the amendment to the visitation and custody statutes? He did not. That being so, his arguments with regard to due process evaporate. With regard to retrospective analysis, I think the statute, in order for retrospective invalidation to be considered, there must be a right to that which is claimed now, or at the time that the right or disability, as it were, as it's been argued by the respondent, attached. And that right or disability with regard to supervised visitation attached when Mr. Cannon pled guilty to the crimes at issue.
He alleges he had a right to apply for unsupervised visitation, which was retroactively denied by the passage of this statute. And I take it from what you're saying unless he already had it, it wasn't vested?
That's correct, Chief Justice. I think, as I pointed out in reply, I think that had he had, at the time the statute was amended, had he had any rights of unsupervised visitation at that time, then the statute's amended, then it would operate impermissibly retrospectively to take away a right he had before. Now, the analysis that the respondent made with regard to the sex offender cases, you know, you're not liable to register as a sex offender if your offense occurred before the date that the statute requiring registration was passed. I think the same analysis applies here. I mean, he didn't have unsupervised contact, didn't have custody until the statutes were amended. And I speak statutes plural because I believe the respondents brought up the applicability, the possible applicability of Section 452.400, which is simply the visitation statute. Now, that statute's even more restrictive. It takes away visitation entirely. And I think that if you applied that statute, that we would have a problem. However, we're talking about Section 452.375. I believe the motion to modify sought custody and visitation. And if that were the case, 452.375 applies exclusively, which by its own terms of the amendment, precludes any award of custody or unsupervised contact. Now, yes, Ms.
Didn't you say in your pleading or your briefs that custody had not, they disclaimed any intent to seek custody, or isn't there some disagreement as to whether custody was a change in custody was also sought below?
Yeah.
I know the order addressed it. But.
Yes, and that's part of the second point on appeal is that Mr. Cannon, in his colloquy with the guardian ad litem, it was plain and simple. I mean, the guardian ad litem said, custody's not an issue, is it? This case is about visitation only, isn't it?
In cases, though, when you are dealing with child custody or visitation, the trial court has ability to order the full range, including as long as it's not an issue of notice originally, the court can order custody or visitation in orders that the parties don't ask for, can't the court?
Oh, certainly, Judge Breckinridge.
So there's nothing wrong, even if he didn't ask for it, the court had the ability to order it.
I think so. I think so. I made reference to cases which state that the court cannot provide the kind of relief that is not requested. However, I think the respondents pointed out quite capably, I might add, that in child custody issues, as you just pointed out, Judge Breckinridge, that best interest of the child applies, and the court has at its disposal the full gamut of considerations to take into account. And in this case, that's what Judge Schulmeyer did. However, I think his hands are still tied with regard to 452.375 in its amended state because Mr. Cannon did not have the requisite custody or unsupervised visitation rights prior to the amendment. Now,
but doesn't the application of this law impose a new disability on the father?
I think not, Judge Russell. I think it's a disability that he already had prior to the amendment, if you want to call it a disability. He already had no unsupervised contact. Now, the fact that the statute precludes him from seeking unsupervised contact, that implies the next analysis in turn, which is that the off-quoted principle that if you have a mere expectation that the law is going to stay the same, that's not enough to give you standing later on to assert that your rights were denied once the statute's passed.
But it certainly changed his rights to visitation with the children in that now it has to be totally supervised.
I would say it didn't change his rights. It changed his expectation of a right. He had an expectation that he could go into court and get a court to say, all right, Mr. Cannon, you've rehabilitated yourself. I think the kids are going to be okay in your care. You'll have unsupervised contact. The statute does not allow that.
You're relying on the cases that say you don't have a right to rely on there being no change in the law in the future. You don't have a vested right in the current law if it doesn't affect you now, and you can't assume that it will remain the same in the future.
Correct.
Don't have a vested right in it remaining the same in the future, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to contemplate somebody can't come in later on and challenge the statute because, hey, I wasn't consulted with regard to changing the statute. That opens the door to just an indefinite number of arguments.
The time sequence is that the offense that he committed was prior to the amendment of the statute.
That's correct, Judge Wolf.
And the original divorce or dissolution decree was prior to the amendments.
Correct, statute. Judge.
And so the question is whether the consequences of the conviction at the time of the conviction can be changed going forward. And that's what some of those sex offender cases are about. And do you distinguish those?
Yes, I can. And I think I did in a reply brief. And I would like to point it out right now. The cases cited by the respondent with respect to, I believe it was, forgive me, I can't remember the name of the case, but it was the recent case where the offender was living within 1,000 feet of a school at the time and the statute was then amended, and then he was expected to move. Well, that imposes a new obligation or disability, if you will, that he didn't have prior to the amendment of the statute.
I think that was the RL case.
That's correct, mm-hmm. Judge Tomlin. And I think that is not what we have here. I mean, Mr. Randall wasn't having unsupervised contact before. Same thing of the offender who was living within 1,000 feet of the school. The statute's amended. Now Mr. Randall cannot have a
He was living within 1,000 feet of the school, but he had an expectation that he could continue to do so. I don't see what the difference is between having a right and having an expectation with respect to the retrospective application.
Well, the difference is that that comes down to the vested right analysis. The vested right. You have a right that's settled, absolute. It's yours. Mr. Cannon had a vested, absolute, settled right to visitation with his children, albeit in a supervised setting. You apply the statute as amended, it does not take that away. He's got exactly what he had before.
But there are a lot of interests in this. Often in a criminal case, it's about the accused criminal or the person who's been convicted of a crime and the public safety. But here we have a child. And in the legislature, not only dealing with the rights of the parent, but the legislature may be saying that we need to protect the rights of the children vis-a-vis a person who's been convicted of a sex crime.
And I think the legislature has spoken. I think this question that's arisen really is a question for the legislature, not this court today. I mean, the court's being asked to pass on whether or not it's retrospective in its application, and I say it's clearly not.
Well, actually, what the court's being asked to do, the trial court in any event, is to determine what is in the best interest of the child.
That's correct, Judge.
And the argument that you're making is that there is an intervening statute that should take the discretion that the judge has and cut out parts of it?
Well, not really. And I think my reference to that case in my reply brief with respect to it, the Walsh case, if I'm not mistaken, maybe the Gardner case, that talks about the method by which the court comes to a custody or visitation arrangement is procedural only, such that we're not going to, if that's the case, it forecloses any inquiry with respect to whether it's constitutional or whether it affects substantive rights, which then implies that.
Right. But you're not here arguing that the best interest of the child has been compromised by the trial judge's order. You are simply here arguing that the statute has to be imposed, notwithstanding what the trial judge found was the best interest of the child.
I believe so, Judge. I think the legislature has already spoken as to what is in the best interest of the child in this very narrow context. You have a sex offender who committed sex offenses against a child. That person is not allowed unsupervised contact. It doesn't strip away all contact, only unsupervised.
But aren't you arguing in point two that even were it not for the statute, that the best interests of the child are not served by custody and unsupervised visitation?
Certainly.
I think that was the question.
Yes, Chief Justice. I think should the court then find it unconstitutional, the facts themselves don't lend themselves to any award of either joint legal custody, where there's absolutely no evidence that they can communicate with one another to make decisions regarding children. And Mr. Cannon is an incurable child molester and pedophile. I mean, both the experts opine on that regard. At the very least, he's an incurable child molester, a distinction without a difference, in my opinion. I see that my time is running out. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court?
Yes, it does. Could you tell me, what's the evaluation of this program? He passed a program successfully regarding is there a great success in that program as far as recidivism?
The Most Hot, are you referring to the Most Hot program through the Department
right.
of Corrections?
Right, that's the program.
It's my understanding that approximately 26 to 33% of the individuals that participate in that program complete it. Our client was one of those individuals that completed that. I think there were some statistics that trial put out about rate of recidivism and the validity of some tests and diagnostic forensic evaluations that were performed. I understand the static 99 indicated he was at the least level for recidivism rates. In regard to most,
what is the recidivism rate?
Well, it's
the successful the 26% that successfully complete the program. What is the recidivism rate?
Well, I don't necessarily know that I know what the specific recidivism rate is in the state of Missouri, Your Honor.
Well, what's that?
I don't believe I know, Your Honor.
Oh, you don't
know what that rate is. I would argue that since you brought up the MOSOP program, I would submit to the court that our client successfully completed that. He now finds himself in a predicament when he successfully completes that, gets a pat on the back, and the trial transcript says everybody there sends him on his way and says go out in society and thrive and prosper. He successfully completes parole. He's basically sent out in the world, so he believes he's not a threat, and maybe the MOSOP program is too successful in that when he leaves prison, he sees himself as rehabilitated because everybody's telling him he's fine. He has no other parameters after he's released on parole of restrictions of what he can do absent the sex offender registration. And he's now disenchanted or finds himself in a circumstance where a retroactive application of a law based upon a prior conviction is going to deny him the opportunity to seek or have unsupervised contact or any kind of custody.
Didn't one of the experts say that he was a pedophile and incurable, and the other said he wasn't because, if you could explain for me the criteria you thought was not met, but that he was a child molester and that was incurable, if I understand what opposing counsel says. Do you disagree with that characterization of the testimony?
Well, I don't disagree with that characterization of the testimony. I would submit that if we're going to talk about due process and retrospective application, talking about something that's incurable, even sexually violent predators in the state of Missouri have an opportunity for post-deprivation hearings once they've been confined to an institution. I believe every year the department can petition, or if not, they have the ability to petition. post-deprivation review to determine whether or not they are still a danger and whether or not they suffer from a...
Well, by saying he was still a child molester and it was incurable, isn't that saying that he was still a danger, because then he wouldn't be so characterized?
I don't think that is saying he's still a danger. I think that's what the best interest test that the courts use to determine custody is designed to do. I think the procedure is already in effect. In essence, if it's not broken, don't fix it. The procedure is in effect for the trial court to consider all the relevant factors, certain enumerated but not an exclusive list, when determining what's in the best interest of a child. Certainly the fact that he has been diagnosed as a pedophile, certainly the fact that he's been diagnosed as a child molester or has a prior conviction, should be relevant to a determination by a trial court judge as to what's in the best interest of a child. But to presume unfitness based on that one sole criteria...
Can you tell me then, because that's point two of the brief, is that it was not in the best interest of the child for someone who, even your own expert said, was still a child molester and uncured, and he thought uncurable. How did the trial court find that was in the best interest of the child?
Well, apparently the trial court analyzed the custody and visitation pursuant to the statutory factors, and the information gave weight or credibility to the witnesses. Gave weight or credibility to our client.
Tell me, because we review this, so tell me why I should find that wasn't an abuse of discretion. As I'm just, I mean, don't refer just to the factors. What in the factors made that not an abuse of discretion?
Your Honor, if I could defer to Ms. Michael on that issue.
Okay.
She was going to argue point two on the
That's
factual
fine.
Basis.
Great, thank you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Fortunately, I know there's not a CASA volunteer in this community. What was the recommendation of the GAL?
The recommendation, and again, this goes to a factual determination I think might be contained in point two that might be better suited for Ms. Michael, but I understand the recommendation of the guardian ad litem as to the female was some form of supervision, but as to the male was no supervision.
Well, let me go back to the constitutional issue then, which I take it you wanted to focus your time on.
Yes.
If we agreed with your argument that it would apply to prohibit changes in the rules regarding changing from supervised visitation to unsupervised visitation or full custody, because he had a vested right in having those options available to him, in effect, is what you're saying. Wouldn't that then invalidate an awful lot of laws that, for instance, you couldn't pass a new law saying child care workers cannot have a prior felony involving children, or other any kinds of laws, not just in this area of sexual crimes, but in any other area? If you add new requirements, if you add new specifications, and say you have to have a college degree, or previously you didn't when you graduated from college, or you had some other requirement that would prohibit you from taking a job or having a relationship with someone you used to be able to have, wouldn't all those laws fail? And wouldn't we have to overrule all those cases that say this retrospective laws prohibition in our Constitution does not mean you can't make new you can't make new laws based on past facts, but you simply can't make impose disabilities retroactively?
Correct. Well, and that's, I think, Mr. Nancy draws a fine distinction on the vested right. I'm not so sure that I read that as strictly as he proffers to the court. But as I read the court's ruling in Phillips, it's not in the conjunctive, it's in the disjunctive. You can have a vested right, you can have a new disability.
So if it's the new disability, what's the new disability solely based on past facts? His point is it's a new motion to modify. The motion to modify was brought after the new statute. You're asking for additional rights, not rights you previously had.
Right. Well, but I don't think it's restricted as narrowly to rights that you previously had. Mr. Cannon had an opportunity at the time of his conviction to obtain unsupervised visitation.
So it'd be the same. What if at the time of his conviction you could work in the child care field despite being a sexual predator or having a sexual abuse conviction, and that was changed and saying, no, you can't run a daycare if you have that? He would have had a right to run a daycare before, so would that law be invalid?
I mean,
where is this taking us?
I would argue that it would be invalid.
Okay.
Pursuant to, as I read Phillips, and I may be misreading Phillips, but I don't think so. As I understand this court's determination in Phillips, it said the registration, and that was in regard to registration, and understand that, as you may recall, that was in the civil context. It wasn't an ex post facto criminal context, but Phillips was purely in the civil context. This court said the registration requirement was invalid because when the person challenging the registration pled guilty, they had no obligations to register, and the duty to register stemmed only from a subsequent change in the law.
So, because the prior conviction, suddenly there was an additional imposition, they had to register But here, what additionally did he have to do because of that change in the law?
He didn't have to do anything. It's a new disability that's imposed on him, which is the failure to be able to seek relief that otherwise was afforded to him before
but
the change.
Phillips of the law. Didn't address that situation.
I'm not going to get into the facts.
Go ahead. Well, if that's true, then wouldn't every father, even those that hadn't gone through disability proceedings, be able to allege that same right? In the sense of, I understand in this case, you know, there was a divorce and now this is a motion to modify, but right. What about a situation where the couple remained married? I mean, is that any different? I mean, doesn't his, as I understand your question, his right is just because he was a father and he had a chance to have custody or visitation?
Well, an unmarried, and that goes into a portion of the due process and equal protection argument. I think the invalidity of this law is that it doesn't treat married and unmarried offenders in the same fashion.
But I think the question went to, say you were married and the new law went into effect and you got a divorce after the new law. Couldn't a parent in that case say that, well, you cannot apply the no unsupervised visitation provisions to me because when I married, I expected that if I got a divorce, I would have a right to unsupervised visitation. Where's the limitation to your argument? I think that's what the question is.
Well, I guess the limitation would be for this court to decide based on the facts and circumstances of that case. Here we have a disillusion, and he had something. And he had an opportunity to seek something alternatively that was then taken away from him.
Okay. Why is that
based
not
solely on the past conviction? I apologize.
Why is that not an expectation rather than a vested right?
Well, it may be an expectation. It may be a matter of semantics. I'm relying upon the disability, which is his inability to therefore achieve something he otherwise had the ability to
either change. Take away a vested right or impose a new obligation based solely on past acts.
Correct. Or create a new disability. I'm reading that in the disjunctive, not the conjunctive.
So getting to the comparable treatment, what if there was a couple, parents, and then the father was a child molester, and they never got divorced?
Okay.
And yet he went to jail or whatever happened, and he came out and he never got divorced. Are we saying that the law would allow him to still be the full unsupervised custody of the child when they've never got a divorce?
If there's no divorce,
right?
I believe as it stands now, he could exercise, and that's one of the highlights I put in my brief of how this disparately treats a class of persons, is that somebody who is not divorced could be convicted of a similar crime or the exact crime as our client, then the restriction on custody or visitation would not apply.
I think if you're going to get to the factual part of the argument, you better yield to your co-counsel. So,
thank you for your arguments.
May I please court? Chief Justice, as to your question regarding the pedophile child molester diagnoses, basically, Dr. Harry testified that he had simply reviewed the records that were available regarding Randy Cannon's treatment in 1999 and 2000, around the time of his arrest, conviction, and incarceration. Only one of those records from St. John's Mercy, where he spent about 24 to 48 hours, was on suicide watch. It was definitely a dark day for Randall Cannon, was he diagnosed as a pedophile. Both Dr. Harry and Dr. Clark testified that neither of them could find anything in the medical records that they reviewed, and they reviewed the same records, that would fit the criteria or the access for pedophile.
Well, it wasn't the only issue regarding whether or not he was attracted to a person of the right age. Otherwise,
it was an entire there was much testimony regarding the DSM and what year and the which would be the definitions of pedophile versus child molester. And I believe that Dr. Clark was more credible in the fact Dr. Harry simply defined pedophile as by the known treatises and accepted definition in their field. Dr. Clark said he doesn't fit all of those, and I honestly, off the top of my head,
I thought there was some distinction about whether the activity lasted longer than 6 months, and that was the only
question. Yes, I think it was something to that effect. I mean, or it had something to do with the age of the child, meaning this child was prepubescent or, she was, it's disputed, but she was between the ages of 12 and 14, and So Dr. Clark, who did extensive testing on Randy Cannon, did diagnose him as a child molester, but that's simply because it fit the one criteria. The child was under the age of 18.
There's no question that he did molest this child.
There's no question that he did molest this
child. And then what we're talking about is psychologists and psychiatrists ruminating over whether they're a child molester or a pedophile, but he did molest this child.
Absolutely. And the difference, though, that why it becomes important is because both experts testified that a pedophile is likely to re-perpetrate on another child.
But
a child molester, and especially Randy Cannon, is unlikely to do that.
But I thought they said he was still a child molester and it was incurable.
You can never lose that diagnosis. Once you've committed that act, you can never lose that diagnosis. It's simply similar to alcoholism.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
So he did not testify when he said he's still a child molester. He was not testifying. He still had the same urges and tendencies. And
absolutely.
So
in his report, he was very clear that Randall Cannon was not exhibiting those things that he was 8 years ago struggling with, that he had found methods of treating and self-preservation almost, and preservation of the children. He put the children's needs before his own. He was exercising self-restraint. There were numerous factors that Dr. Clark pointed to that showed that Randy's likelihood to re-offend was minimal. But he couldn't give him a zero. That's the nature of the field. They couldn't give him a zero. Nothing's guaranteed.
Because even though he completed the MOSOP program successfully, it's not a program designed to cure him of that diagnosis of those tendencies.
Both experts testified that there are many mental illnesses that are not curable per se, but that the treatment plan should be put in place for these mental illnesses. And that's exactly what has happened with Randy. He has gone through extensive treatment.
But this is all sort of soft science. It's not like the science has come up with some idea that in 2 years there may be a vaccine or an injection that could cure people of cocaine addiction.
It is a soft science.
It's a soft science. It's all people trying to do well and trying to do good, but it's all a matter of testing, surmise, opinion, but there's nothing there that's a hard science.
I'm getting the red light. If I could answer that question. It is a soft science, but that's why it's so important that the trial court be granted the discretion to evaluate all the factors, because everything is a case-by-case situation when you're talking about a family with children. How the children react, the mental capabilities and influences that the children have, that the parents have, that's why it's so important that the trial court be granted the discretion to include that factor in their analysis. That's why the weight of the evidence was so extensively in favor of our clients, because we had the experts, all the supervisors who witnessed visitation between the children and Randy testified as to no fears, Randy Cannon's
thank
brother.
You. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, Ms. Michael almost went down the path of comparing Mr. Cannon to an alcoholic, and I'd like to take you down that path with regard to considering, and all due respect to people who've been diagnosed as alcoholics, I mean, you have people who recover fully, then you have people who don't recover fully. They relapse, you put a drink in front of them, leave them alone in the kitchen with a drink, and next thing you know, alcoholism is taking over again.
Do you have any statistics on recidivism? Do you have any statistics on recidivism of the 26% that complete the program successfully?
Well, Judge Teitelman, I think...
I believe I asked that question before. Never mind.
I'm sorry, sir.
Never mind.
What I'm trying to point out is that Mr. Cannon may have done this, that, and the other thing to address his pedophilia, his child molestation, child molester status. There is a similarity between that and the alcoholic. However, we're talking about somebody who raped a child, raped and sodomized a young preteen and then a teen child. That behavior is very dangerous. The legislature, I think, contemplated that because this behavior is so dangerous, I think what the legislature did is, all right, let's give him visitation, let's make it supervised. Okay? I think that's plainly what happened here.
Let me interrupt you.
Yes,
your
ma'am.
Opponents argues that the law is unconstitutional if it imposes a burden or it takes away a vested right, that it's in the disjunctive, and you're arguing that it is not, that that taking away a vested right has to be part of the analysis. How do you respond to their claim that it's either or?
Well, I don't think that it is either or. I will answer that question. I think this question is a question of vested right. There's no.
Do you agree it imposes a disability?
No, I don't agree with that at all. In fact, Your Honor, I pointed out in reply that the kinds of disability that we're talking about here, and I point out the Missouri Merchandising Practices Act was amended to provide for punitive damages in a case where the claimant's right accrued before the amendment was passed, such that now the defendant would be subject to punitive damages where the defendant was not subject to punitive damages. That's more of an affirmative disability to do something. In this case, pay a punishment. Mr. Cannon is not paying a punishment. He's not being punished like he wants to assert to this court. It's all about Randy's being punished. It's not. It is about protecting children. It's not a disability that he didn't.
But the analogy of MPA doesn't really hold up, because in MPA, the Attorney General could always seek penalties against the defendant. It was just a matter now they allowed punitive damages to be sought by the private Attorney General. So it wasn't like the malefactor wasn't under some kind of illusion that he could not be penalized. They could have been, but the Attorney General just expanded the people that could pursue that.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that giving that private right of action, private right to punitive damages, is what the court addressed in that case.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The case is submitted.